Welcome to Global Leader Radio, sponsored by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, discussing ideas that matter with people who care. Now here's your host, Director of Business Development and Instructor of Management for the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University, Alvin Miles.
Happy Tuesday and welcome to another edition of Global Leader Radio. The purpose of our show is to engage in conversations that highlight our guests, educate our learning community, and add value to all who seek to optimize their leadership acumen. So we achieve this purpose by providing our learning community with key takeaways, including resources and advice that have led to the personal and professional success of our guests. And we've got a great one today. So with that overview, we welcome today's guest, Ms. Karen Robinson-Cope. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful, and what a great intro.
Well, thank you.
Happy Tuesday. Love it.
Exactly right. So Karen Robinson-Cope is the EVP of Business Development, but as we'll learn a little later, that may be just a little bit of a misnomer within her title. Now, Karen oversees new business development and strategic partnership activities for NanoLumens. She's been instrumental in the planning, strategy, and growth of the company. Karen is a serial entrepreneur who has been CEO of four different high-growth venture or angel-backed companies over the last 20 years. And most recently, Karen was president and CEO of Prime Point Media, one of the largest alternative out-of-home advertising companies in the United States. And prior to Prime Point, Karen was chairwoman, president, and CEO of InRev Corporation, a technology company that was acquired in 2001. She's been recognized by Atlanta-based Women in Technology when she won its Women of the Year in Technology Awards in 2000. She was also named to Wireless Weekly's list of top 20 women in the wireless industry. So Karen is a frequent speaker at both the regional and national levels, and she's spoken at numerous universities, including serving on KSU's Executive MBA Lessons in Leadership panel last month. She's also an investor in and a board member for numerous private and public companies in both the United States and Canada. So she's truly a global leader. And her passions are her family and her community involvement. So along with her husband, Rick, they live in Atlanta, Georgia. Am I correct?
You absolutely oversold me, but love it.
So welcome to Global Leader Radio. So I see you're doing well as always. You've got great energy, and we love that.
Thank you.
So to begin with, please tell us a little bit about Karen Robinson-Cope, starting with your original birthplace. Home, a bit about your work experience, and bring us up to the present.
Well, again, thanks so much, Alvin and Kevin, for having me here today. I love spending time with Alvin, and I love what Kennesaw is doing, and it's just a pleasure to be here. And I did not start out in a likely situation as an entrepreneur. I was actually born, or my husband likes to say, my parents said I'm from Roswell, New Mexico. And for those of you who don't know, Roswell's that funny place in New Mexico. But I was born in Roswell, New Mexico. And my father at the time was with the United States Air Force. But he and my mother were both from small towns in Arkansas. Hmm. And they were my father was the first one in his family to go to college.
Wow.
Again, to their credit, we moved to California shortly after my father left the Air Force. He worked for Litton Industries, which was one of the first multinationals in the early 60s. And my father was given an opportunity to go to Taiwan. And by the way, to show my age a little bit, back then it was known as Formosa.
Wow.
Not Taiwan. But we actually went to my parents, to their credit. The Litton Industries asked my father if he and my mother would be interested in, this is literally the mid-60s, if they'd be interested in going to Taiwan. And my father was going to work with the Taiwanese Air Force on inertial navigation systems. And I'm so pleased, so blessed, because my parents said, why not? So they, who came from families in Arkansas, went across the world to Taiwan, and not even to Taipei. They went to a little town called Taichung, Taiwan, which,
wow,
I just think is fascinating. To this day, I'm convinced, because in Taichung, it was not a big city back then. Now it's a very booming metropolis. But back in the mid-60s, there were two types of people that were there that were Westerners. There were either missionaries or spooks. Ah. So my father passed away about 2 years ago, and on his dying, I said, Dad, you can tell me now, weren't you really a spook in Taichung in the 60s? And to his dying day, he said, nope, I truly wasn't. But anyway, it was a great experience. We spent about 4 years in Taichung. Then we went on, came back to California, spent some time in Singapore, and then Korea. So I spent almost 10, 11 years of my youth growing up in Asia. And I think though my father was not an entrepreneur per se, and my mother was a traditional stay-at-home mom. But I think two things that were just great lessons for me. Number one is every year when you live overseas, especially in those days, every year your company would give you home leave tickets. And they typically would give you business class tickets, and you could fly home. My parents would always turn those tickets in, buy cheap tickets, and go a circuitous route. So we were in Russia in the early 70s. We were in India in the late 60s, in Tokyo in the mid 70s. So it was a great experience to literally travel the world. My mom and dad and my older brother, my younger sister and I, taking the Eurail pass and literally hiking in the Himalaya Mountains, going to Nepal, you name it. What a great experience. So the first thing I learned from my parents was really the joy of not only meeting people, but really a kind of learning that from the ground up.
What a great point. That's a great point.
It was just a terrific experience. And I think that's one of the things. And then in addition, you learn risk taking. Because it's, when you're living in a hostel in, Dakar or something, it's a very different experience than going to the Hilton or the Holiday Inn in, in downtown Rome. And I think it was a great experience that literally we would jump on the train and sometimes we wouldn't even know where we're gonna spend the night. We'd jump off in a city. We'd have each have our one little suitcase. I also learned to pack very light. So from my very earliest days, I've always been a very light packer. I take less than one suitcase.
Interesting.
And anyway, so just a great experience. And, my parents, my father and my mother have always been my biggest supporter. Even though my father's been gone for almost 2 years now, I can feel him in every endeavor I do. And he and my mother were always my biggest champions.
Fantastic. So it sounds like he's still with you in spirit.
Absolutely.
So you grew up in Asia, and so that got you, when you came back to the States and you began your work life, your career life, tell us a little bit about how that got you up to the present.
Well, again, showing my age a little bit, before Alvin was born, in the 19, I graduated in the early 80s, and literally, if you all can remember, that was just at the very end of the very high gas prices. There was a very deep recession going on. The only job I could find was in a retail training program. So I actually joined May Company, which has now, I think, been purchased by May D&F. And I started out, and the great thing, people have this idea that retail is all about fashion. And anybody who knows me knows I have no fashion sense. I have no creative talents. That's not me. But I found early on that retail is not about that. It's all about numbers. It's about understanding what your customers want, trying to solve their needs, and understanding the metrics. And that was a great lesson for me as I started in my early 20s, starting my first career. And leave it to Karen. Early on, I had the opportunity, the normal program that you join when you actually join an executive training program like that is you have 6 months here in the field and 6 months in the buying office. Well, at the time, at the time, after I had a very successful kind of store management role, they wanted me to go to corporate. And I said, I don't want to do that. And so, again, early on, I was able to set sort of my own rules. And I demonstrated to them that I could do a better job for them actually in the field, continuing to be promoted in the field. So at the age of about 23 or 24 years old, I was promoted till I was a divisional sales manager. Okay. So I was one of the youngest divisional sales managers in May Company's history.
Wow.
I had about 100 employees. And it was a great experience because I learned people skills. I learned most of my subordinates were probably 20, 30, in some cases 50 years older than I was.
Wow.
And I really needed to learn to, A, management from the ground up, which is a lot of listening, not much talking, a lot of walking around, a lot of humbly asking for guidance, advice. And I was able to win over a very mature management team. By, again, asking a lot of questions and trying to better understand how I could be of service. And that was another great learning experience as I've continued in my career. I was fortunate. The great thing about retail is you get to get promoted quickly. The bad thing, it's an awful lot of hours and not a lot of money. So I was offered an executive training program with AT&T, and I know that you were there early on in your Bell career. Great executive training program, and I know you and I have actually spoken about that, Alvin. Great experience. I went from – I headed up phone center stores in Southern California.
Nice.
Then I moved to the headquarters in Baskin Ridge, New Jersey, and spent about two and a half years there. Great experience that I learned. One of the great things I learned about my experiences, my days at AT&T, was the value of the excellent training we got. And that's why, again, I applaud Kennesaw, because they're so good about teaching that full range of real good academic as well as real life learning experiences. I got that at AT&T. Again, this was the mid to late 80s. I moved up pretty quickly, and I had some great mentors that worked for me, but I learned some just amazing business skills. But early on, and this is, again, to show our age again, and you younger women will not know what I'm talking about, but in the mid-80s, there were very few female CEOs, very few. And I remember one of my mentors who ran a privately held company, an entrepreneur, said, "Karen, you're never going to be CEO or even a VP at AT&T, so you might as well just go ahead and leave. You've gotten all the training you can get from them." So you all laugh, because now there's so many fabulous women executives and CEOs. But in the 80s, there was still a pretty rare breed. And so the great news is I learned wonderful experiences from them, wonderful training. I don't regret it for at all, but it was a great launching pad for me to go into an entrepreneurial business. So I, through a series of a couple companies, I was either brought in as the, I was at about 29 years old, I became a vice president at an earlier stage company. Then I went to a company here in town on payment processing, National Data, where I was the vice president. And then I got the chance, the president at the time of that company, a dear friend of mine and one of my mentors, Dr. Mark Bronstein, was the president of National Data. He had made an investment in this battery charging company. And he said, "Karen, I've got this investment. Why don't you go take a look at it? Because I really need some help in sales and marketing." So that was really my first foray into a true CEO entrepreneurial role.
A battery charging company?
Battery charging company. And people used to laugh because we sold a lot of customers, we raised a lot of money, and to this day, it's a joke, I don't understand the difference between voltage and current.
I love it.
And it just goes to prove that you don't really know, customers don't really want to know about the bits and the bytes and the volts and the currents. They want to know how you're going to solve their problems.
Yeah.
And I learned early on, and I almost use that as a badge of courage, because if I would have gotten too into the technology, I had a Russian scientist and a group of Russian scientists, PhDs, that had built this technology, and they wanted to go into extensive detail about all kinds of bits and bytes and voltages and currents and you name it. And I quickly said, that's not what customers care about. Let's focus on solutions.
Yeah. It reminds me of what I've heard before. Sometimes when you ask a person what time it is, they want to go into telling you how the watch was made.
That's a great comment. And again, all they want to know is they want to know if they're late for lunch. That's all they care about.
I love it. So what does the EVP of business development do on a daily, weekly, and monthly, and even yearly basis?
Well, probably need to go back just a step on that conversation, because, again, when I sold my last company, and by the way, I've been a CEO of a battery charging company, electric vehicle company, and an out-of-home advertising company. So I've had a full range of very disparate, which goes to prove to show that, again, the problems and the business issues we face really are somewhat transferable, and the key is getting those basics, and then listen to your customers, listen to your employees. But in 2006, I was blessed to be able to sell a company where I was brought in by the founders to a Canadian public company. And it was a great return for our investors, a great return for our employees. A number of our employees made over $1 million in the transaction.
Wow.
So it was just a win-win for everybody. And I took that opportunity to became semi-retired and spent a lot of time on my passion, which is helping women in the developing world, specifically Sub-Saharan Africa and Central America. But my husband, in parallel with this, had found a company. He was a judge for World's Best Technology in Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. He was working with, and this is a international competition where they match mentors with universities and colleges, typically professors, where they've got a great concepts but need help commercializing it.
Okay.
And they matched the two together. And one of the companies my husband had that year, and this was 2006, 2007, was a company in actually Toronto, Canada. And they had a little tiny, and I'm showing this to Alvin, literally it's about a 1-inch by 1-inch little flexible square that had a flashing green light on it. And my husband thought, and their goal was they thought they could make a flexible display material. Hmm. And my husband saw this little tiny 1-inch by 1-inch square, and he had the vision to say, I think I can make, if you want digital wallpaper, I can make a display as big as a wall. And to this day, I say, Rick, how did you from that little tiny piece of plastic figure out how to do it? But he had that vision. And he spent about 3 or 4 years getting it into kind of working on the technology. And in 2011, he came to me and said, Karen, I'm ready to start selling this. You need to come in and help me sell it. So he recruited me in 2011. I came in. We had very little sales, a couple $100,000 of revenue at that point. We came in, and my first year there, I worked on trying to develop what's the business model, the value proposition.
Uh-huh.
Again, not the voltage or the current.
Right.
They want to know exactly what solution are we providing to the customer, how will they pay for it, how can they justify the cost. Spent a lot of time on that, spent some time on really clarifying and articulating what that benefit, the benefits are. We figured out who to sell it to, what the channel is. We started to hire a sales team. Then we started to get our first customers, and we were so blessed in our first year. We were able to get some of the best customers literally on the planet, Capital One, Estee Lauder, Coca-Cola, Universal Studios, Macy's, just an unbelievable set of customers. And we're able to, in a couple key verticals, we were able to demonstrate the nanolumens advantage, which is essentially, it's like a TV, but it's super thin. It's super lightweight, so you can literally hang it on a wall.
Hmm.
It is very energy efficient, so it can run 24/7. It's still cool to the touch. It's long lasting because it lasts. It's based on what's called LED technology, so it's based on very, very long life. It can run 24/7 for years and years, up to 10 years. And the unique patented piece that that Rick brought to the table was he brought together a group of scientists from around the world and was able to make flexible. Hmm. So literally now, as opposed to your TV at home, we had displays that you could wrap around columns, you could put on walls. We just put one on Park Avenue in New York for a very large financial transaction house, if you will, a banking company that is literally at 90 degree corners. So it's it's just amazing. And so what I help do is help establish who those customers were, how to sell to those customers, how to price it to those customers, the right markets to go after, and then get marquee or anchor customers in every one of those key verticals. And over the last year and a half, we were able to do that. And in each of our verticals, whether it's out of home, i.e. transit advertising, whether it's retail, whether it's financial, whether it's sporting clubs or whatever, we were able to get it key clients in every one of those. And so we are just blessed. We just brought on the best sales and marketing VP I've ever met. He just joined the company just a few weeks ago, and that allowed me to go over and do strategic partnerships, business development, et cetera.
Wow, that is fascinating. So you and your husband form a formidable duo. I mean, he's the idea guy, and then you come in and you implement. You make sure that the channels are satisfied, and you get people to sponsor and you find places for everything to be able to work together, right?
Absolutely. Sometimes it's when I was actually my husband and I have a 11-year-old daughter, Alex. Hello, Alex. Alexander Mara Cope. By the way, that's named after the Mara, the Maasai Mara and the Mara River in sub-Saharan Africa.
Uh-huh.
But our daughter, when I was actually pregnant, I had to stay at home for almost 6 months in bed. She was a high-risk baby, and she's beautiful and just the delight of our lives. But my husband actually filled in for me. So we kind of take turns. Sometimes he works for me. Sometimes I work for him. I would suggest I like working for him better, but he says he has the same boss at home as he does at work. I don't know about that.
I love it. So what is it about entrepreneurship that's always appealed to you?
I think a couple things. I think, number one, I'm very much of a doer. And the thing about being an entrepreneur is when you identify what needs to be done, you can do it. And to me, and the good news, bad news, is the decisions you make have a big impact. I mean, when I was at AT&T, no matter how great I did or how poor I did, the company wasn't going to go out of business and they weren't going to, you know, double in growth.
Understood.
Because your decisions are somewhat mitigated by all the other, the process and all the decision makers around you. One of the things I love about being an entrepreneur is you can make an impact. Mm. I think the second thing that I love about being an entrepreneur is you can sort of set the rules your way. And what I mean by that is in one of my early companies, I knew that I had just been blessed. My husband and I had just had a little baby, Alex, and she was still, a toddler. And I had an opportunity. Did I want to go run a company where I was going to need VC backing?
Right.
Or did I just want to kind of keep it smaller? And I chose to keep it smaller because I didn't have to raise VC money. I could raise friends and family money. And what that meant is my daughter, from the time she was born till the time she was probably 6 years, 5-6 years old, she came to the office every day with the nanny. She had an office in the corner office. In fact, she grew up thinking all kids had corner offices. I said, no, honey, they're bedrooms, not offices. She grew up, the nanny was there every day. And I knew I couldn't have done that if I would have been a venture capital backed company or even had raised a lot of money, because the investors are going to want you to be there without having distractions. And even though I would argue a daughter is not a distraction, they might disagree. So one of the second things I loved about being an entrepreneur is being able to make those choices. Mm. And having my daughter there was just a wonder. My husband and I had tried so hard for so many years to conceive. And when we finally were able to conceive, we wanted to enjoy every minute of it. And to have her there was I could have only done that.
With your own company.
With our own company.
Yeah.
And I think the third thing is being able to set a culture the way you want it. My husband and I are both Christians, and we are allowed, and again, everybody at our company is not a Christian, and we don't expect them, but we can set the culture, and we can run it as a company that believes in the golden rule and so forth, and that's just very clear about it. And I'm not sure you could do that at a bigger company. Again, we're very open. We've hired people from all religions. That's not an issue, but we can set the culture the way we want to, and we can impact our customers the way we want to. And to me, that's priceless.
Yeah, and customers do care about that, right?
I think they do. I think without a doubt, when I look at some of our employees who've come from company to company with us, and some of our customers who've been with us in some form or fashion when we've gone from a company to company, and I think they do respect that.
That's interesting. So I noticed there's a great level of community involvement, a la philanthropic involvement in your bio. How do you choose which nonprofits you'll partner with, both globally and domestically?
It's a great question. And I encourage, Alvin, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think all of us, we're so blessed to live in the United States, to live in this wonderful city of Atlanta. We have a responsibility to give back.
And I know you believe that,
if there's one thing I'm going to say repeatedly is whatever you've been given, you need to make sure that you're giving back. And I like to think that my husband and my daughter, our family, believe that, our company believes that. But I think a question you should ask before you ever undertake is you need to ask some questions. You shouldn't just find yourself falling into some sort of philanthropic venture. Mm. For my husband and I, it's a couple things. Number one, it is important to be faith-based. They don't necessarily have to be, but we want to know that there is a set of morals and set of ethics that is consistent with ours. I think the second thing is we're big believers, and not in any way that we're sexist, but my husband and I believe that when you help women, especially in the developing world, you quite often you're helping a community. You're helping, and let me give you a specific example. Typically, and we'll talk a little bit later about this, but one of the types of organizations I get involved with are typically ones that help economic development at the lowest level. You can call it micro lending, you can call it savings trust groups, all kinds of things. We believe in that because a high percentage of the recipients are women.
Mm-hmm.
And typically we find that when a woman is successful in getting a step up for herself, the first thing she does is she helps her children. She gives them food, typically protein, and education. And we find out that in the development, it's been proven again and again that when children are fed and they can get an education, your community improves.
Wow.
So we're big believers, not only, but to us, that's an extra bonus point. It's about the women helping, and again, sustainable. The other thing that I love about the charities that Rick and I have been involved with is that we love the ones that are respectful. I think that Americans are so generous, Westerners are so generous, but sometimes I feel we might go into it and it's about how we feel.
Okay.
Don't we feel good when we go to a homeless shelter? And I think it for any of you who've done it the Christmas and you've given the toys to the family that maybe is in a tough time and you watch the husband, he sometimes kind of saunters, kind of gets out of the way because it's not respectful to him. Hmm. He wants to be the provider of his family.
Right.
And when somebody comes in and says, let me show you all the toys I've given you, think about how that makes him feel.
Understood.
And I'm a big believer we need to the charity, there but the grace of God go me, go you, go anybody we know. And therefore, we're big believers, can we respectfully? And my favorite story, one of the nonprofits, ministries I'm very involved with, where I just joined the board, and is Opportunity International. And Alvin, I was so pleased to see you there at our event last week. And by the way, it's got a hometown connection. Vicky Ascara, who was the CMO of Delta, one of the highest-ranking women at Delta, she left, worked closely with Shirley Franklin, mm-hmm. our beloved mayor.
Yeah.
About 7 years ago, she left Atlanta. We missed her. She moved to Chicago, and she headed up a charity called Feeding America, uh-huh. which is about the food banks, you know, helping children, and again, across the country, get more and healthier foods. Well, we were able to recruit her to Opportunity International, which is the largest and the oldest faith-based micro-lending organization, about the same time as Muhammad Yunus with the Grameen Bank. Mm-hmm. And the whole concept here is you loan money, and these are typically to the poorest of the poor. Just as a matter of fact, about 2 to 3 billion of the world's population unfortunately lives on less than $2 or $2.50 a day.
That's now, fascinating.
By the way, guys, that's probably you probably spend more than that on Starbucks every day.
Yeah.
And when you think about again, 2 to 3 billion people are in that level. And unfortunately, a majority of those are women.
Hmm.
And one of the Opportunity International has a mission that their job is to help those 2 to 3 billion people that live on less than $2 to $3 a day. They help them and get them with typically a loan. And by the way, these are not the loans we're used to. The average loan may be $150.
Right.
And they pay it back usually in 6 to 8 months. And then they typically, and by the way, they pay these loans back at the rate of about 98%. Let me just make sure. I think we in America could learn some things from that. Literally, more than 9 out of 10 people, almost 10 out of 10 people pay back those loans, which is great. But the greatest story, and then by the way, we provide insurance for them. So in case there's a drought or in case someone is, unfortunately, their family, someone's hurt with AIDS or some sort of debilitating disease or death, they're able to recover and they still can pay back their loan and continue to not be wiped out. We provide training for them and savings for them. But one of my greatest stories, and I think this goes back to the respect, there was a situation where we were literally in a village and a little old woman who had to been, you know, 90 or something, she was so proud and they were using her as example that for the first time she had a little business and I think it was probably raising chickens or something, you know, and she'd gotten probably $30 to get some chickens and then she had a pretty flourishing business and there was an American with me and they were so proud because they said, you know, the folks from the nonprofit were saying, and this is the woman, let's call her Sheila. Sheila was helped. And oh, by the way, you know, Mary Jo, your loan was one of the loans that helped this woman.
Wow.
And the guy was so proud. He said, yes, I helped provide that. And the woman looked him straight in the eye and said, and I'm the one that paid you back. Now, is that not – that's a financial transaction of two equals that is about respect.
Yes.
There is no charity
yes.
in that transaction. That's the kind of story I just love and why I'm so passionate about Opportunity International.
So fantastic. So the three things that you look for, you and Rick look for with regard to the nonprofits you'll partner with, the number one, faith-based, and I don't think you put any priority on
no.
these. Faith-based, in other words, they need to have morals and some type of ethics. They help women become sustainable.
Right.
And that they're also respectful overall.
Absolutely. Those are three very important for us. We're big believers that just like a business is well-run, I think quite often we donors expect our charities to not pay any of the staff, not do anything for marketing, and that's not good business. So we're big believers. Let's make sure we have the right people in place.
Okay.
We're so thankful about OI getting Vicky because she is just a fabulous CEO and a wonderful leader.
Mm-hmm.
And she's spending the money on marketing, but she's also spending it to making sure the programs, the right staff are there to implement. And we're big believers in making sure we have the right charity, the right mission, the right employees, and then we get out of their way and do everything we can to support them.
Fantastic. We've been talking with Karen Robinson Cope, the EVP of Business Development. Karen's role at NanoLumens is to oversee new business development and strategic partnership activities. She's been instrumental in the planning, strategy, and the growth of the company. And her and Rick together have built a pretty impressive portfolio of companies over the last few years.
Thank you.
And so, Karen, as we give a little bit more thought to you as the leader, we spend a little bit of time up front wanting to understand who you are, kind of where you came from, your background. And so now we'll start pivoting toward, you know, you from a leadership perspective. So how would you describe your leadership style?
A couple things. I think, number one, I am the opposite of a micromanager. If the one thing I'm criticized for as by either my boards or whatever is I probably sometimes don't get hands-on enough. I like to believe in hiring the best people, not necessarily the most experienced people. Recognize what I'm saying. I'll take someone who's super smart and with a good attitude, a lot of energy any day of the week over someone that's got 20 years of experience.
Attitude's important.
Attitude and raw intelligence and risk-taking. I'm a big believer in give someone, if you're really going to push the boundaries, and when you're talking about entrepreneurs and new ideas, you're typically pushing boundaries. I'm a big believer that you've got to give your team the ability to fail. And one article written about me years ago said I embrace failure, and I was a little, you know, not sure if I like that as my headline. And the more I think, you know, it's one of the things I am very proud of. Embrace failure. Because if you're not failing, if you don't give your team the ability to fail, they are not going to be able to push those boundaries. So I like to hire smart people, enthusiastic people, people that are willing to take charge. And when they screw up, we say, whoops, mistake, course correction. Let's figure out what was wrong and then go down, you know, path B. I think that from my style is big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Let them, because I'm not, as you probably have figured out, Alvin, I'm not a particularly detail-oriented person. So I'm big about presenting the picture, painting the story, and then giving them, making sure I understand the resources.
Right.
I like to think of myself as an enabler. I resource. I provide the tools they need, get out of the way, and then I provide some timely feedback. And then at the end of the day, if you've hired those right people, in the majority of the cases, it's going to be a good win.
It's going to work out.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So what's the most important lesson you think you've learned as a global entrepreneur?
Before you said global, let me talk about American entrepreneur, because
okay.
I do believe there's
All right.
a different story. I think from an American, I think that I really believe risk taking is
okay.
is one of the most important. You've got to be able to, and I think risk taking. As an entrepreneur, you have to be willing to make decisions when you only have 50, 60, 70% of the information.
We call it tolerance for ambiguity.
And that is, that's my new buzzword. I'm going to start using that one, because you have to have it. When you're moving as quickly as we move, almost every situation I've ever seen, you're going to be better off making a decision, 50, 60, 70% of the information, but timely, than you are to try to get 100% of the information, because in this day and age, when you wait for 100, that ship has already sailed and you've missed it. So you've got to be willing to make the decision. The caveat I make there is you've got to be able to course correct. The new term in business day is pivot.
Mm.
Whatever you want to call it, you need to say, we went down this path. I made the decision for the what I thought were the right reasons. In retrospect, I now have new data points. Wrong, course correct. Move on. And you've got to have and I think Rick believes 100% the same way, you have to have an organization that tolerates that and to some level actually embraces it.
Mm.
And then the key is course correction. And I think time after time again, you're going to find that the most successful companies had failures along the way. So I think that coupled with the ability to make decisions, tolerance for ambiguity. I think those are very important as an American leader.
Okay.
I think international, I would add one other thing. There's a cultural / process bias that I don't think I've fully appreciated, even living overseas, as long as I've lived overseas, as I have over this last 10 years. And I think it's critical to understand the country, understand the people, look at other companies that have been successful there, try to get partners, local partners on the ground that you're working with, because I think that internationally, there may not be as much tolerance for risk.
Okay.
B, you may not be able to course correct as quickly as you can here. In the United States, we almost still have this Wild West mentality. And I think overseas, especially in certain European countries or maybe Asian countries, that you need to be more respectful of that phenomena.
In that culture.
In that culture.
So there is and there's an element of having to be observant with regard to taking those risks from an American point of view. Let's go back to the American point of view you took us through earlier. With regard to moving forward, taking risks and course correcting, between those taking risk and course correcting, you have to be observant, correct?
Not only observant, but you have to have wise counsel, whether that's a board. Whether that is your management team, you need to have, you know, two ears, one mouth, a reason. You need to listen. You need to be willing to get the feedback. Sometimes that's hard to do, especially when it's your, you know, your vision, your strategy. But you need to be willing to do that. And you absolutely have to be observant. I also think there needs to be a period of time of even a thoughtful reflection. So once you take in the information... And I actually had a failure, a very big failure early on in my career. And I, just like a death in the family or a divorce, I had to take a moment and say, okay, what happened? What did I do wrong that I should have changed or could have changed? Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, what are some things outside of my control that I can't beat myself up on? And to me, that was a very healthy process. And when I mentor, or when I talk to entrepreneurs or even, you know, women executive or executives, I share that story because I think you need to give yourself a period of time to really reflect and then say, okay, now what am I going to do different? It's too easy to keep making that same mistake. That's not, those are not successful entrepreneurs. The successful entrepreneurs that are open about their failures say, I failed, I regrouped, I analyzed, I moved forward, changed. And that's, I think, the right kind of process that when I look about, when I think about what's made me more risk taker, but more successful, it's because of those things.
So in your perspective, what you're thinking is that once you've made whatever decision you've made, and if you have failed, you will continue to fail unless you sit down and debrief or at least give some reflective thought.
Absolutely correct. And part of it too, not only from the learning perspective, but there's certain things that sometimes bad stuff happens.
Okay.
And you need to, and beating yourself about that, I've heard many entrepreneurs, boy, in 2001, I could have sold my company for $73 billion and something happened, and they continue to rehash that. And that is not only not healthy, not productive, but
they can't do anything about it.
They can't do anything about it. So that's a win, that's a loss, loss, loss. Get on, move forward.
So how do you and Rick choose your top management teams?
Oh, great. So many of them we've worked, and we're so blessed to have such a great management team. Many of them have worked with us before. Some of them, again, we use kind of this, I think the litmus test would be, A, you know, honesty, integrity are vitally important. I think when you and I were speaking recently, a friend of ours from AT&T said those are non-negotiables.
Yes.
There's a certain amount, you cannot... When you're in the trenches, you need to know that the person on either side of you has the same value system, at least on that level. So those are non-negotiables. You don't even get in the game. I think number two, and this recent this executive VP of sales that we just hired is, I did his reference checks, and they were amazing how terrific they were. So I go to people I trust and say, what's your experience been, either when they worked for you, when they worked with you, when they sold to you, when they bought from you? talk to me about them. And I take those, to me, those personal references are very, very important to me. And I think lastly, I've become a better believer or more of a believer in whether it's psychological tests or anything, those traditional
assessments
that I probably discounted before. But I've realized that's just one more. It's not the only data point, but it's one more data point that I think helps me to better understand not only this individual, but how, and equally important, how that individual fits with the team.
Yeah.
Because remember, we're not hiring individual performers. We're hiring teams.
That makes sense.
Not just how the individual works, but how does the individual work as part of a team.
Oh, I like that. I like that response. And particularly intriguing for me is the one you gave second. You said you're going to check the references with people that they buy from, sell to.
Right.
Continue on with that
one again. In other words, I want to know not that you were golfing buddies, which is nice. Those are nice. That's a nice reference too. But I want to know, did you buy from this person? And if so, what was the experience like?
Interesting.
Did you sell to that person? What was the experience like? Were they a good customer for you?
Hmm.
Were they an employee? Were they a good boss? So people typically have a very myopic, and if I just check with their boss, then that's all the reference I need to get. I would challenge you, especially when it's a critical hire, you need to do the 360. Customers, vendors, subordinates, including maybe in the administrative assistant.
Wow.
Because how people treat the support staff, I would suggest, is a very strong indicator of their character.
Hmm.
And if you check those some of the things, that'll give you, I would suggest, a more complete picture of the individual.
Very great point. So what have been some of the key mistakes you've seen entrepreneurs make?
Oh, I think there's I've made many of them myself, so it's not them, it's me. One of the reasons I'm so open about talking is I wish someone would have shared with me, because I made so many mistakes early on because I did not have the pleasure or the blessing of having counsel, mentors, et cetera. And I just am so open about trying to share that. But I think the mistakes, people do one of two things. They either hire good talent way too early, or they hire them way too late. It's their college buddy, and we start with, and your college buddy could be a great partner when you're just, you two and no customers. Mm-hmm. But when you're a $50 million company and your, college buddy is still, your head of sales, and they, may not be a good match, put it that way. So I think the thing I always try to look, and then flip side, I think the problem when hiring too early is some people, especially big company people, there's this terrific amount of talent that came from AT&T's of the world and, Bell South's of the world and Motorola's of the world. Good news is we can get some of those people now as entrepreneurial companies. The negative is sometimes we entrepreneurs don't know how to use them effectively, and they get frustrated, or we silo them. And so I think that I'm a big believer, if you're going to hire great talent early on, i.e., you really need a $20 million executive and you hired a $200 million executive, I think that's a great strategy. You just need to understand how you're going to utilize them and how they're going to grow,
okay,
how you're going to grow them. I think the probably more likely, though, is they wait too late. A good friend of mine who's a recruiter says, and then thirdly, we hold on too late before we fire them.
Okay.
And I hate, again, that's a hard thing, and I know it's very difficult for me, much easier for many of my colleagues, some of my friends, but it's harder for me. But the reality is, if it's not a good fit, it's probably not a good fit for them either. And I think you were even saying that quite often, if you set the expectations and they're not performing, you need to fire quickly.
Yeah.
Letting them hang on is like the third degree, trauma victim that you just let them slowly bleed. And you need to, for the organization, for everybody, you need to do it respectfully. I'm a big believer in, providing, whether it's a severance or, and typically, you hired them for a reason.
Right.
Help them find an opportunity where their skills fit in.
Mm-hmm.
But again, too often, I think the biggest mistake entrepreneurs make, if I were to summarize one, I'd say they probably wait too long to fire.
What a great point. And speaking from the voice of experience, obviously.
From the voice of experience.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about COBA, the Council of Board Advisors. And the reason why I brought that up as part of this conversation is because you and I were having an offline conversation that spoke to the ability to bring in board advisors for a company at just the right time.
Great comment. Well, thank you for giving me that lead. I was, again, I've been a CEO for about 20 years. and been, again, some great successes and one pretty abysmal failure. But in every one of those, I had the advantage or the blessing of having a board. I always had outside investors, and when you have outside investors, you need a board to protect their interest. Mm-hmm. So I always had the benefit of having a third party oversight that had that literally I had to listen to. Well, I was had the fortunate experience of being a judge for the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, which is one of the great granddaddy entrepreneurial organizations. And they every year, and they've been doing it for 25 years, they choose an Entrepreneur of the Year in certain categories. And they actually have a worldwide one. And it's a very big honor and some of the biggest names. I think here in town, clearly, we've had many of our CEUs, including obviously our Home Depot executives, I think were one of the big winners. So it's a great, great program. And I spent 2 years being a judge there. And I was surprised because you had all these excellent, great companies that were profitable and growing, and they had no board.
Hmm.
And I was very surprised that in some cases, 60 to 70% of the companies, and these are profitable, growing companies that had no board.
60 to 70%.
Correct. I was surprised. Second fact that I started thinking about, why is that? Then, if you all recall, 2007, 2008, 2000, there was a really deep recession. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these CEOs realized that things were not always rosy, that there could be, you know, a down year. It could be a couple down years. It could be very painful because they had had year after year of growth. And when I started talking to some of these CEOs, both through as a judge for Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year as well as just mentoring, it was amazing to me that so many of these companies, when they reflected, I asked them a few questions of what happened, why did the downfall, why did you have to fire the people, lay off the people, shut down. Almost every situation, the cause could have been prevented if there was somebody that was not in the business but looking outside the business in the business.
And had their best interest at heart.
Third fact was Atlanta is a unique place. We've had a lot of very successful companies. You look at MSA and all John M. Lay and all those wonderful companies that were spawned from that. And yet you start to look at them. So many of the great CEOs or even great corporate executives, when they have a liquidity event, they retire.
Mm-hmm.
For many reasons, many often will move south for tax reasons, for you name it. And I would suggest that Atlanta is missing out, that we don't have the ability to keep that intellectual capital. Silicon Valley, one of the things that made it so great is you have, you know, the CEOs from 10 years ago company that became venture capitalists that are now supporting the next generation who are supporting the next generation. And you have this whole ecosystem of these companies and these CEOs and these mentors that are helping each other.
Uh-huh.
Atlanta, I'm afraid, because of a number of reasons, we're not on a beach. We do have a state income tax. Quite often people were missing out. They leave. They might come back here for their child's, you know, graduation or a golf game or charity, but they're not here and they don't want to work full time. So they're not going to invest in a business and be sucked in 24 hours a day. They don't want to do that. Put all those facts together, came up with a nonprofit called COBA, Council of Board Advisors,
mm-hmm.
only one that we found in the world. And it's like it's a combination of a peer group, like a YPO or YEO or kind of one of the peer groups, and consulting. It's a combination of both those together. And what we do in a nonprofit setting is we bring 2 to 3 to 4 high-level C talent, a CEO, retired CEO or transition CEO. We bring them in, and their job is to help the company's management team.
Mm-hmm.
And we like to call it like to opine. They ask questions and they say, have you thought about you're going down this path, Mr. CEO? Let me tell you an experience I had 5 years ago. You might want to ask this question. And what we find is that the companies, it's kind of a precursor to a board,
mm-hmm.
to a real board, a governing board, but it gives them the wisdom of this vast talent and expertise. the retired executives get to give back. They can either play golf or they can, you know, give some of their gray matter back. And they, most of the times, successful CEOs, they want to give back, but they don't want to give back 24/7.
Right.
This is a chance they can either go help, you know, a charity on a Saturday plant trees, or they can come four times a year and help a company grow.
So there is some type of limit on the number of hours.
There's a number of hours. It's very limited because it's really about not helping. We're not a replacement for consultants.
Okay.
We're there to literally help the CEO think better, think differently, think outside the box. And we've been doing it for about a little over a year. We've had five companies that are in the process of going through the program. We're in the process of adding another 5 to 7. Our goal is over the next few years to add 30, 40, 50 companies. And we're growing jobs. Mm. We can see the results. We can see the impact that these board members are having. The board members feel engaged because we're building a community of intellectual capital helping these early stage companies. The companies are then growing, and they're, you know, one of them just did a terrific acquisition of a UK company, and they give a lot of the credit to the COBA board.
Hmm.
And we think over time that this is going to build a new group of mentors to help this next generation. And we're all about growing jobs. So it's a community partnership. We've tried to bring the chambers in. We've brought the mayor's office in. We're trying to bring the universities in. So over the next few years, we think this is a great model we can start to take to other cities. And we want Atlanta to be known, just like the Kauffman Foundation has become very successful for startups.
Mm-hmm.
We think Atlanta, with our excellent university system, with all of our fabulous companies and these great not only Fortune 500 companies, but earlier stage companies, we think that we can potentially become the thought leader for privately held, profitable kind of mid-stage companies.
Wow.
Now, I'm not a nonprofit person. As you've known me well enough, Alvin, to know that. So I had to find a home for this because I'm not a believer in let's go start lots of nonprofits. I'm a believer let's work with the existing nonprofits and figure out a better way.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and looked at a variety of groups and chose a group called TIE, which is the Indus Entrepreneur. Now, Alvin and Kevin know that I'm not Indian and I'm not male, and yet I am the incoming president for TIE. TIE is a group started 20, 30 years ago in Silicon Valley, by a group of Indian, both venture capitalists and very successful CEOs. It's now grown. It's the largest entrepreneur organization in the world. It's a nonprofit, and it's all about the play it forward, pay it forward concept,
mm-hmm.
about giving back. And the Atlanta chapter, we have about 100 charter members and I don't know how many, you know, thousands of regular members. We have a monthly programming, and the whole idea is to help entrepreneurs at every stage. So we help the high school students.
Mm-hmm.
We help the early stage entrepreneurs. We help them through my program, which is the COBA program. We help them through social investing, working with Dr. Muhammad Yunus with social investing. And then lastly, we work with corporate innovation. So we try to partner entrepreneurs with big companies, Home Depot, Johnson & Johnson, Kimberly-Clark, help them bring new ideas into their businesses.
Wow.
So it's a whole ecosystem. But the thing I love the most about COBA is this is a great opportunity for our members to give back in a very structured way, and our companies are becoming better companies. So it's a great program. I'm so thrilled. I've got to announce today that two of my dearest friends have now become co-chairs of this initiative, and they are doing a significantly better job than I could ever do. Sarah O'Brien and Sandy Hoffman have taken the leadership, and they are now taking it to the next level. And it's a great situation because it was a great idea. Like I'm a true entrepreneur. Great ideas, or take the idea and kind of take it to the next level, and then let just excellent executors, and they are coming in. I had a meeting just before I came here, and they have got phenomenal plans for it over the next 2 years, and I can't wait to be with them on that ride.
Well, fantastic. So tell us again what that acronym stands for.
COBA, Council of Board Advisors.
Okay.
And it's what we call, it's a pillar or a platform for TIE, the Indus Entrepreneur. And that could be at TIEAtlanta.org, I believe, is what it is. It is a nonprofit. And again, the great thing about this is all about the advisors make a small stipend
mm-hmm.
because we want to have a financial transaction.
Correct.
We want to be respectful. This is not charity.
Mm-hmm.
This is these advisors helping these companies to grow and get better. And I am just so excited that Atlanta is the birthplace. And I think it's going to be a great movement over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, very good. Very good. So let's talk a little bit about what you've seen as an entrepreneur and a leader, moving through the ranks and making decisions. Have you seen a whole lot of ladies, you know, in the entrepreneurial world?
It is, and I am also just blessed in a play. I'm going to do a shout out to my girl, my dear friend Jen Bonet. Jen runs an organization here called Startup Chicks, and what a great name, Startup Chicks. It's not up Startup Ladies, it's Startup Chicks. Anyway, she's actually started to take that to some other cities. I mean, she works closely with Ty on that one.
Okay.
And what they do is she brought together, again, she was part of one of the hot companies in the late, I believe it was the late 1990s. And she was one of the top four executives of the team. And so she did the boom and then the bust. And again, she has been challenged that, you know, if you want to do something about this, you need to go help women entrepreneurs. So okay. My dear friend Jen has brought together a group of phenomenal group of mentors. She's got some of the greatest ladies in Atlanta that have been successful entrepreneurs. And every year it's a training ground for startups, women run startups. And we have a business plan competition where they come in, they present, they're coached by these terrific group of serial entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, and corporate executives. Then the top five or six are then chosen, and they then have very extensive mentoring. And then at the end of that, those companies, it's just a great group of companies. It's been around for a couple of years. I think this year she had 25 female startups, and they range anywhere from an energy drinks to there's a great company that's got a platform for scientists to be able to – it's like a Facebook for scientists. It's a great one. She's got another one. There's a sports analytics tool. I mean, just these terrific companies that these women have developed. And here in Atlanta, again, we've got a terrific group of startup chicks that are helping, or I don't know, startup hens, I don't know what we call them, to help the and it's not an age issue, because we have some of our startup chicks are, you know, in their 50s and 60s, and some of them are in their 20s. So it's just a great, great group. But that's a shout out to Jen Bonet. That's Startup Chicks, and I think it's also a 501c3, and I think it's startupchicks.org. Don't quote me.
I believe so.
So, yeah. Kevin, you're familiar with this group, right?
We've had him in the studio before.
Okay, fantastic. He's well aware of the startup chicks and chicks in general, perhaps.
Chicks in general, exactly.
Yeah. So with regard to women and what they do in leadership, what do you think leaders should do more of, particularly women?
I think a couple things. I think we've heard this many times before: is get passionate about what it is. You know, you're spending so much time at. Don't play by the rules. And by that, I mean you've got to do your current job really well, but you need to think about what you love. What do you care about? Is there a way to incorporate that as either your job or part of your job? I think that's number one. I think the second thing is women typically, and I think a great example is when, especially in corporations, when we have a male and a female that are both equally qualified, they ask the guy if he wants the job, and he says, I'm surprised you didn't ask before. Of course I'm ready for that job. Put me in tomorrow. And the woman says, well, I may need a little bit more training. I may need to think about it a little bit. Let me check my balance, my work-life balance. I think women go for it. You just need to go for it, ladies, because, again, we have the same – we clearly have additional challenges because so much of the work life, the home life sometimes does fall on your shoulders.
Right.
I think Sheryl Sandberg in her new book, Lean In, had a great comment, which is, you know, pick a spouse that is going to be as supportive as you, is going to fill in. My husband and I kind of – we literally say sometimes we're interchangeable. Mm. He can do the home thing. I can do it. I can do the work. He can do the work. But, again, when you're given an opportunity – don't think about it, but say yes. That's what our male colleagues are doing. Jump in, and then we'll figure out the details later. I think the last thing I'd say is, and that's why I'm such a big believer in team sports. Team sports teach you how to play on a team, how to win, and how to lose. And I think women, we're getting better with Title IX. More and more of our female entrepreneurs came from sports teams. But I am such a big believer, because that whole locker room concept, everything about what a guy has gone through, they learn how to win fairly, they know how to lose fairly, they know how to become buddies with the opposing team. Many women are just starting to learn those. So okay. I think, again, for you younger girls, get on a team sports. Get out there. Learn how to, you know, get on the soccer team. Get on the lacrosse team. Learn how to win. Learn how to lose. Learn how to be friends with the opposing team. Women in corporations or in startup businesses, jump. I've actually done a speech where I jumped off, my husband and I, literally I did a bungee jump off the brain dead, Tanzania, the big river in Tanzania. Brain dead, sorry. Huge river. Jumped off. There's a thing of me screaming, saying, "Oh my God!" And I use that to start because to me that truly typifies women jump. You got the line, jump. We'll figure it out. And then I think the last thing is quit feeling guilty. I think there's been this whole argument, and I'm not going to go down the argument of, you know, work-life balance and the whole thing. What I'm going to say is, A, it's life balance, and our Alvin's and my mutual friend Rudy brought that up to our attention. But I think the other thing is I find it hard to be great, to be 100% at everything all the time. Right. So when I'm at work, I'm 100% at work. And when I was going on the speech and at Kennesaw, my daughter called with a challenge of school thing. And I wanted to be there and I loved her. And I said, "Honey, I love you, but mommy's going into a big speech right now. You need to hold that." My daughter's 11. She's not three. She's 11. So she understands time. I said, "Honey, I love you, but mommy needs to be prepared. And I can't feel guilty about that."
And be present.
I got to be present in the moment. And when I was there, I loved every minute. I love every minute of this one here. I'm not thinking about my job. I'm not thinking about my daughter.
The phone off.
I turn my phone off.
Wow.
I am 100% here. And ladies, let's live it. And I don't mean that as being self-centered or self-absorbed. I mean, when you're there, give it everything you got. Don't feel guilty thinking about what I should be, could be, would be doing. And then when you're home, for God's sakes, you spend 100% on your daughter, your son, your family, your dog, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And don't be thinking about, I should have, could have done it at work. Be present in the moment, and I'm a big believer of that, and leave some of that guilt somewhere else. It's just not a productive emotion.
So when you give it all you've got, there's no room for regret.
There's no room for regret because, again, when you failed, you said, you know what, it's part of the bigger thing. I was stretching my wings. I was pushing it. Failure's good.
Yeah.
I'm there all about it.
Yeah, before earlier we were talking about some of these points as well, and so the second point you had is look, you just need to jump in and say yes. Don't wait around. So the thing we ended up saying really is, you can't opt out if you haven't opted in.
And that's my other news. Alvin's got my other news. I love that, and that's so true. Ladies, let's opt in. We can always at some point in the future opt out. You know, when you're gonna the family, whatever. And by the way, when my father passed away 2 years ago, I had to ask permission from many of my friends. I said, "Folks, I got to opt out. I am opting out right now because I've opted in the last 2 years, but my priority is right now my mother, my father, my daughter, my husband." And that's the priority. And I did not feel guilty about, I cut back on the social, I cut back on the work. Ladies, opt in. You could always opt out afterwards.
Yeah, what a great idea, and also a great set of learnings that you pass along to us as well. So thank you for that. So as we start to wind this down, what do you think is your leadership legacy? What are you most proud of as a leader?
I think I'm most proud of, I think, a couple things. I think number one is that I am very open and honest both about the failures and the successes, and I think that is something that I've been able to help a younger generation, whether it's getting comfortable with failure, whether it's getting comfortable with opting in. And I think that there's it's always been a passion of mine to help younger entrepreneurs. I don't mean age-wise, but earlier entrepreneurs in their career. And I think my honesty is something that, because I'm so open, I think maybe it's opened the discussion for other people to talk about failure. Silicon Valley is pretty open. Mm-hmm. In Atlanta, I'm not sure I could get venture capital funding probably could now, but I couldn't for years because I had that one failure. And I was quick to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
I think the second thing is that I'm a big believer. I feel that my Christian faith has been part of my conversations, part of, I think, every... I hope that every engagement relationship that I've had with whether it's an employee, a customer, a vendor, has typified what I stand for, and I'm proud of that. I think that's part of my legacy. And I think lastly that through both my time as a mentor as well as angel investments, that I think that I've helped other entrepreneurs. I'm a big believer in that everything we've been given, my husband and I feel that the Lord's challenged us to invest it wisely, and that is in people, whether that's entrepreneurs here in Atlanta or in the U.S., whether that's a woman in Rwanda that wants that first loan to do her, you know, her chicken farming. I think that I can say that the resources I've been given, excuse me, Mm-hmm. I think I can look anybody in the eye and say I think I've invested them very wisely.
Okay.
And not from a financial return, but from a human return.
Yeah, well, take your time. So now I think that what you've given us is some pretty good stuff with regard to your legacy. Number one, that you're open and honest about your failures and successes. Number two, that your value really emanates from your Christian faith. And number three, that the things that you've done within your personal and professional life, as well as your, giving back to community, as well as your philanthropic pursuits, have helped other entrepreneurs. And so you've done that in a variety of ways. And I have to tell you that I'm most impressed with that.
You're a kind man.
And so with that regard, so now let's get to the final question of our time together. So we will make both the audio and the video of your answer to this question available on our web posting. So take a moment there and tell us which book has most impacted your leadership ability.
You know, I love to read. And by the way, one of the things that, just as a quick sidebar, one of the things that I would encourage you, it was great advice given to me. I've become a big believer, and again, part of because I've always asking the questions, very inquisitive. I would encourage all you entrepreneurs out there that for the next 6 months, I want you every month or two, I want you to get a new magazine. I want you to pick Popular Mechanics. I want you to pick the National Rifle Association or Rifleman. I want you to pick, Field and Stream. I want you to pick InStyle Magazine. I don't care who you are. I would encourage you. It's a great advice given to me that is part of our inquisitive nature, and to be a good entrepreneur, a good CEO, you need to be aware of what's going on around you. So my challenge to you all is take advantage of all the great reading material out there and challenge yourself for the next 6 months or a year to pick up 6, 8, 10 different magazines and every month read a different one to get a different perspective. And while I have read many books and I try to read at least, I take my guilty pleasure on planes is reading magazines and books, and I just devour them. But saying that, and I could go quotes from many, 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 many books, but I think for me the number one is clearly going to be the Bible. Mm. And I think I've heard there's so many great lessons. Whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, I think the lessons in there, whether you talk about the Proverbs, just good common sense, whether you talk about Jesus' teaching, again and again, I find so many great lessons, regardless of your religious beliefs, that really have helped me to become a much better leader. And it's something that I really encourage others to just go in and read and use it, not from a spiritual perspective, but from just good guidance.
Leadership.
Good leadership.
Yeah. So it doesn't really matter if it's the King James Version or any other
doesn't
type.
Doesn't matter.
Just go grab the good book.
Just go grab the good book because there's some good advice in there.
Well, fantastic. And Karen, on behalf of our learning community, we've learned a lot from you, and we appreciate you accepting the invitation to join us today. So I would certainly love to have you back on the show at some
always.
Point if we can get our schedules together.
Always.
Is that a deal?
It's an absolute pleasure. I enjoyed it. It's always fun to talk with you. And again, I just – thank you for the opportunity, for all you're doing for the community. It's just a real pleasure to see what you're doing about giving back. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And as a special thank you, I have a copy of Business Acumen 2,
yes.
Insights from the Faculty and Friends of the Coles College of Business.
Yes.
And with that yes and smile and affirming attitude, we'll bring this edition of Global Leader Radio to a close. So we invite all our listeners to check our web presence for previous interviews and links to valuable leadership resources. So also, please drop me an email at acm0996@kennesaw.edu if you have recommendations for guests. And for those of you interested in our award-winning Executive MBA program, please go to the EMBA icon on our Global Leader Radio site to connect with us and sign up for an information session. So join us again at this same location for the next edition of Global Leader Radio, the show that discusses ideas that matter with passionate people who care. So have a great week.
Global Leader Radio is brought to you by the Executive MBA program at Kennesaw State University. Take charge of your personal development and professional career today by learning more at KSUEMBA.com. And join us next week as we discuss ideas that matter with people who care.